You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, you can fuck off. How are we, Alan?
We're even better now, yes.
I just love the intro. Yeah. Okay, so we're talking about the chemical agent in the poisoning of the
Sergei
Russian ex-spy. Now, I want to know, are you saying that Russia did it?
Oh, no, that would be far too much for me to say. But anyway, let's sort of get into the nitty-gritty of this. So Sergei Skripal was a double agent working for both the KGB and MI6, I think it was. He then sort of got caught out, as double agents tend to do. He got sentenced to 13 years jail in Russia in around about 2006. And then, again, as often happens in the movies, he got swapped in a spy swap for a whole bunch of other side spies, and went to live in England. And as everybody knows, it's been all over the news and everything, so he and his daughter still fighting for their lives, unfortunately, following a poisoning in Salisbury. And
so they're still in hospital?
They are, yes. And so as also a policeman, the first guy that was on the scene, I think he's still in hospital as well.
He was affected as well?
Yeah, I think there were about 21 people affected. So
wow.
Yeah, I mean, this is thoroughly
strong poison.
Indiscriminate. You know, it's just awful, really. And so it has been confirmed that they were poisoned using a nerve agent. And the nerve agent that they have identified looks very, very much like it was one of a bunch of nerve agents that were made in Russia from the 70s to the 90s. And so, you know, it's anybody's guess as to who is possibly responsible for this. But, you know, you'd have to say that all fingers are pointing towards sort of the high-ups in Russia. What is a nerve agent, I guess, is sort of, you know.
That's what I was wondering. That's the science part of it.
How does it work? Okay, so you've got this molecule in your body called acetylcholine. And every time a nerve fires, it sort of releases this molecule of acetylcholine. And that's the chemical that basically tells your muscles to contract.
Okay.
And so you fire off a nerve impulse, you get acetylcholine, your muscles contract, and then we've got this thing called acetylcholinesterase, which is a mouthful in itself, and that's an enzyme, and what that does is then it destroys the molecule of acetylcholine after it's done its job.
So that you're not contracting all the time.
There you go, exactly right. So you've got your nerve impulse, acetylcholine, muscle contract, acetylcholinesterase destroys the acetylcholine, and then it waits for the next nerve impulse. Now, as you exactly said, if you can somehow stop this acetylcholinesterase enzyme doing its job, then the acetylcholine is just going to build up and build up and build up, and your muscles are just going to contract and contract and contract, and you'll just go into spasm.
Holy shit. Wow.
So all your breathing and everything, you know, you're gone. And so that's the way that nerve agents work. And nerve agents were first developed in Nazi Germany pre-World War II. So there were two famous ones called Tavin and Sarin. And thankfully, they haven't been, or they weren't used by the Germans, but they were, however, used back in the mid-90s, 1995, there was a attack on the Tokyo subway. I don't know if you remember that. The Om Shinrikyo sect. Shinrikyo. You know, you haven't heard of that?
Nope.
So, yeah, they released all this stuff in the Tokyo subway, and about 12 people died, and this was a nerve agent. This was sarin that they used, so this was the original German stuff that they'd used. And obviously, you know, once one side had this nerve gas and the other side had to get their hands on it, so the British started developing nerve agents after World War II, et cetera, et cetera. And there were sort of two generations, I guess, of these things, and then the Russians came in with this third generation of nerve gases, which were, you know, obviously made by them. And these are the ones, or one of these anyway, that is thought to have been used in the poisoning of these unfortunate folk. So again, it's not an absolute certainty because, unfortunately, if you want to go out and make a nerve agent and you're a halfway decent chemist, then you can do it. It's not too difficult. Okay, so it's not like polonium. Now, remember Litvinenko, the guy that got poisoned with polonium about 10, 12 years ago? So he got poisoned with polonium, and polonium can only come from a nuclear reactor, and, you know, there's only so many places that can come from. So that obviously came from Russia, you know. That's
easily traceable.
That was easily traceable. This is a little bit more difficult.
You're saying because a lot of people would be able to do it?
Yeah, basically. You know, the recipes are out there if you know where to look. And certainly if you're a trained chemist, then, you know, you can do that. And about sort of 15, 20 years ago, a chemist in the States sort of did this just to show that how easily it could be done. And he was testifying before Congress or something like that, and he just decided to try and buy all the precursors to make a nerve agent. And he did it very, very easily, just sent off to the chemical companies, and it all came, and it cost him $130, and he could have made a couple of kilos of nerve agent, which could have wiped out about 10,000 people. So,
wow. Holy shit.
So sadly, if you know what you're doing, these things aren't too difficult to make. The big trick is in not killing yourself while you're actually making them, but, you know, you've just got to take sensible precautions and everything. So
you were saying we're not entirely sure if this particular nerve agent was used, or we're fairly sure?
Given that I probably want to travel to Russia one day, you know.
We can leave it there.
And this will be on the internet, you know, forever. Then
we can leave it there, then. Thank you, though. That was fairly visual, actually.
Everyone's going to try and
it's really, really nasty. I mean, what horrible bloody people would do this, knowing that bystanders are going to be affected and everything. Same with the polonium as well. It was a miracle that somebody else didn't die in that.
Can you explain that, though, in terms of how it does affect, like, is this what form did they release it in?
This vapor?
How does it
hang on, the nerve gas or the polonium?
The nerve gas.
It's not a gas, actually. Most of these things are liquids.
So how does it affect the other people around?
Well, I think the policeman was doing mouth to mouth, I believe.
Okay. Mm.
And I think anybody who just actually comes in contact, I think that's, you know, okay, it goes through the skin and stuff. So,
but if it's liquid, it could have been like through food or all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, okay. All sorts of ways. So I think there's a lot that we're not being told about this, and that'll come out in the fullness of time.
Okay.
So, but it's horrible.
We'll come back to it.
Yeah.
Measles. There's been an outbreak at AUT. Can I just ask, are you infectious?
Well, let's say that one is hardly an outbreak, Lillian. Let's not get sensationalistic.
All right, sorry.
But no, it has been in the Herald and stuff. So, unfortunately, we had one student across the road who was confirmed case of measles. And so as a result of this, you know, there's been a lot going on in trying to identify people who haven't been vaccinated against measles and stuff. And then they're quarantined. They're not allowed to come to university. They've got to stay at home, et cetera, et cetera. And the district health board are running around doing blood tests and everything. So, you know, it's all being handled, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, people are doing a really great job at this. Yes, I am immune because I had measles when I was a kid. So if you're born pre-1969, then apparently chances are you've either had it or you've sort of got some sort of natural immunity to it. So
was it compulsory vaccination before that and then it stopped?
No, it wasn't.
You're just saying because you've had it.
I had measles so when I was a kid. So that was just a rite of passage that you went through. Everyone got measles, mumps and bloody chicken pox, you know.
And the same process occurred? You just stayed home or...?
Yeah, I think so. I can sort of barely remember, but yeah, you went through it, you scratched like hell or whatever, I can't remember exactly, but so I'm okay, but sadly there are people who are not vaccinated, not immunised, and so therefore they are at risk, and as I say, people are busy trying to identify those folks as well at the moment. So
is it like chicken pox, where if you get it as an adult it's harder on your body?
Indeed,
as well?
Yes, yeah, and then that gives you
you're asking us?
Yeah, I know. Okay. That really nasty thing, not scabies. No, I'll think of it anyway. Okay. It's gone. But what I wanted to talk about was sort of the history of vaccination. It just sort of got me thinking, you know, how did vaccination all start and everything? Mm. And, oh, boy. it's a really cool story. I mean, hopefully...
Cool?
Well, that's probably not the word. Not for the people involved necessarily. But so hopefully most of the listeners have heard of the Edward Jenner, who was the first guy to supposedly introduce vaccination. So he was born in 1749 and he became a doctor and blah, blah, blah. He also had interests in natural studies, I guess, sort of biology and things like that. And he was the first person to observe that, you know, how cuckoos go around laying their eggs in other birds' nests.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so when the baby cuckoo hatches, it then kicks all the other eggs out of the nest. or all the little hatchlings and everything like that. They're nasty bastards, cuckoos. They really are.
Just because they want the nest to themselves?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so then the parents have only got this one to look after, and then it gets, you know, that's the way they do it. No brothers or sisters. It's mean.
Yeah.
But anyway,
what's the link?
Where are we going with this?
Well, he was the first person to show that, actually. He was the first person to observe that, and he published it and everything. But in 1796, so...
people were texting in saying shingles.
Shingles, that's it. Okay. Thank you. Shingles.
All right, sorry shingles. to derail that.
Right, thank you, Texas.
Thank you, Texas. Three people.
Somebody's listening. Three people are listening. That's great.
Okay.
Okay, so, Jenna. So in 1796, so he had heard a lot about the fact that... dairy maids, as they call them in those days, so basically the women who milk the cows, they never got smallpox, but they got this thing called cowpox. And cowpox was sort of a mild form of smallpox. And so Jenner was sort of interested in this, and he sort of drew the conclusion that, oh, there must be something here. So obviously if you've had cowpox, then you don't get smallpox, and your face doesn't get all pockmarked, and you don't look like, you know, because that's what smallpox did. And so what he then did was he came across a dairymaid by the name of Sarah Nelms. And that's brilliant that her name is known to history. I think that's fantastic. She's not anonymous. And what she had was some fresh cowpox lesions on her arm and her hand. And so what he did, he took some matter, as they say, out of these lesions. And then he injected that matter into an 8-year-old boy by the name of James Phipps. Yeah, indeed.
Lisa, you're laughing.
I just don't think it would be possible to do it now.
You couldn't do that
back
now.
In the day.
You would not get ethics approval to do this experiment now. You just wouldn't.
That's how now we have vaccinations. So.
Yeah. Okay.
You know,
well,
this entirely unethical experiment led to vaccinations. So this poor little 8-year-old kid, I mean, and again, it's wonderful that his name is known to history as well. And I think he needs a bloody statue or something somewhere because... You know, as a result of him, you know, millions of lives have been saved, and smallpox has been eradicated. It's gone, you know, as a result of vaccination. So these two people, Sarah Nelms and James Phipps, they are heroes of science, absolute heroes. And as I say, it is really, really good that we know their names.
Was James okay?
Well, As it said, he developed a mild fever after having... Oh, yeah, oh, no. We haven't even got to the worst bit.
No,
we haven't
even
got to the worst bit. So after a few days, he said he felt cold and he lost his appetite and everything. And then 10 days afterwards, he felt okay. So then, 2 months later, Jenner took some fresh smallpox matter from a fresh smallpox lesion and then...
Again.
No, this was smallpox. This wasn't cowpox. This was smallpox.
But again into James?
And again into James to see if he was immune. And he was.
Whoa.
That was a bit of a gamble.
So he was potentially giving this kid a life-threatening disease. And it worked. So, you know, utterly extraordinary.
So then they continued more studies?
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, he was sort of running around looking for volunteers for about 3 months around London and couldn't find any.
Funny. Yeah. Can't imagine why.
But in the days before that, they used to actually do a similar sort of thing, but they'd find people who had a mild case of smallpox, and they'd do a similar sort of thing. They'd stuff it up their nose or something like that, and you know, if you were lucky, you got a mild case of it, and then you were immune after that, because that's the thing. Once you get smallpox, then you're immune to it after that. So, so you know.
History of vaccinations.
Dear. Quite remarkable. So there we go.
Wow. Final topic. I think we'll just have to rush through this but this is great news.
Oh, it is. This is all about vaccinations as well. So HPV, so the human papilloma virus, and so we now vaccinate against this because this can cause cervical cancer. And apparently, I was reading one woman dies of cervical cancer every couple of minutes, I think, on planet Earth.
Really?
Which is just appalling. I think something like that anyway. And Australia are going to be the first country to probably eradicate this.
Now,
completely.
What does that mean? Have they vaccinated so that nobody will get it, therefore it cannot be passed on? Or?
Well, they've started vaccinating. That's the thing. So amongst 18 to 24-year-olds, so the prevalence of HPV has dropped from 22% to 1.5% over the last 10
pretty
years.
Pretty massive.
Which is just extraordinary. And so this is a paper that's just been published in a Journal of Infectious Diseases. And they're saying that they're predicting that 30 or 40 years down the track that basically cervical cancer, as generated by HPV, will be gone.
So cervical cancer won't be gone itself.
Yeah, not that, well, you know, this, yeah, as, HPV. Yeah, but the HPV
virus that,
yes,
that yeah, causes, yeah, causes yeah, it.
Yeah. So they're going to get rid of that. So
30 or 40 years. Yeah. That's so not far down the track.
It's not really. And surprisingly, there's only about just over 50% of women in Australia are vaccinated at the moment. And so they've got this remarkable decline because obviously they're starting to vaccinate the young women, you yeah. know. So I think at age 12 or something like that, I think you get...
You can go for it.
I think it's something it's like that. It's very young. Yeah, mm. yeah, yeah. But, you know...
Do we have numbers for, you know, what? How many women are vaccinated here?
No, I don't. I should have looked that up. But
that's right.
But Australia's sort of the world leaders in this one, but I think we're doing this now as well, and... I'm pretty sure, aren't we?
Yeah, we've definitely started pushing it in schools or high schools anyway.
Yeah, so it's not, you don't have to get it. So it's
Wait, so voluntary. Is it compulsory in Australia?
I've got a feeling it might be, but I'm not. That's it. I'm not sure. Oh, geez, I came on badly informed here, didn't I?
That's all right, Alan.
You're asking me all the hard questions
that
today.
That will encourage people to go out and look this up, I hope.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, that's great news, so... Vaccination rocks. And happy Pi Day.
Pi Day?
It's Pi Day.
What kind of pie?
Oh, well, if you're in America, then you know how you put the month before the day.
Yeah.
So it's 3/14,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which are the first three digits of pi,
3.14. Oh, pi. Like, so yeah. Right, we are talking about science. Sorry.
Yeah, we're really not sciencey people.
It's Pi
here.
Day.
It is Pi Day. There we go.
Okay. Hey, that's cool.
Great. Just showcase our ignorance. If it wasn't clear before that.
All right. Thank you, Alan.
Not a problem.
We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. See ya.
That was Dear Science. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.